Well, good evening and welcome to the Arts and Science Lecture, and I want to thank each and every one of you for spending time with us this evening. Being chosen by one's peers to be the Arts and Science Distinguished Lecturer is one of the highest honors that the College of Arts and Sciences can bestow on one of its faculty. It is a peer-determined award that recognizes the significant national or international reputation of an extraordinary scholar and teacher in the college. The Arts and Science Lecture Series was established in 1968 as a means of honoring and outstanding scholars within the college. The lecture series celebrates the crucial academic work of faculty involved in expanding the knowledge base in their disciplines. The very first Arts and Science Lecture was presented in 1968. So Professor of English Lynn Worsham will be delivering the 81st Arts and Science Lecture tonight. And now I would like to invite Dr. Julie Jung, Associate Professor in the Department of English, to introduce Professor Worsham.
To introduce a scholar of Lynn Worsham's stature is indeed an honor. To do so in a way that does her and her work justice, well, that's what we in the business call a rhetorical impossibility. So my plan is to give you a glimpse and then get out of the way. To frame this glimpse, I rely on two related Worshamian concepts: think big and smart it up. In her wide-ranging and distinguished scholarship in rhetoric, feminist theory, and the humanities, Professor Worsham challenges scholars from across the disciplines first to see and then push past by seeing anew the limits of knowledge imposed by concepts narrowly defined. You think composition refers only to a written text? Try, quote, employing composition in the broadest possible sense to designate the primary task or project of human existence. Here, composition refers to the effort to compose a life, a sense of identity, place, and purpose. In other words, the effort to wrest meaning from senselessness. You think pedagogy happens only in the classroom? Try this on for size. Pedagogy refers to the power to impose meanings that maintain and reinforce the reigning social, economic, and political arrangements as legitimate, when in fact, they are entirely arbitrary. You feel as if your emotions are all your own. Afraid not. Pedagogy's primary work is to organize an emotional world, to inculcate patterns of feeling that support the legitimacy of dominant interests. These last two passages are taken from Professor Worsham's hugely influential article, Going Postal: Pedagogic Violence and the Schooling of Emotion, which I like to call the interpretation of dreams for rhetoric and writing scholars, because it fundamentally altered the way we think. We can no longer think of emotions as private, individual matters. Instead, they are political, ideological, and we must work to recognize them as she does, as prevailing forms of social life. This is not an easy task, but then not much of anything Professor Worsham does is easy, and with good reason. As Cynthia Self explains, Worsham's scholarship treats theory as a responsible and responsive reaction to problems in the world, racism, gender bias, violence, and poverty among them. It reminds us all that theories are only valuable when they illuminate and help us address problems affecting the human condition. As editor of JAC and teacher and mentor to many, Professor Worsham inspires others to take on the difficult. The preeminent journal on theoretical scholarship in rhetoric, discourse, politics, and culture. This expansive scope, the direct result of Professor Worsham's editorial vision. JAC provides a forum in which the voices of the most esteemed and the most promising scholars whose work transcends conventional disciplinary boundaries can be heard. In courses ranging from Introduction to English Studies to graduate seminars in critical theory, theory and the literature of trauma, post-colonial women's literature, rhetoric and style, and seminar on Michel Foucault, Professor Worsham demands from her students a kind of deep intellectual engagement that is the hallmark of teachers who take their students seriously. I know this because I talk with our mutual students, like the one who, while discussing a draft of a seminar paper with me, responded to my question, "So what's going on in this introduction?" with, Well, I'm trying to open with an extended example, you know, like Foucault and Butler and Worsham. I know this too because I joined Professor Worsham's Foucault seminar for 3 class periods. And in those 3 classes, I learned more about Foucault than I did in my entire graduate school career. And I learned so much because she set the bar so high, her own deep engagement, motivating me to try and do the same. I will close on this note, that as a mentor, Professor Worsham has helped female colleagues, students, and members of the profession more than she can know. Those of us following in the footsteps of her scholarly generation are lucky in many ways, not the least of which is this: the knowledge that Lynn Worsham has blazed a trail we can follow if we are up to the challenge, and that we are, in fact, up to it. That we must smart it up when others would have us dumb it down, precisely because they would have us dumb it down. That this is the intellectual work of our generation, which is our right and our obligation. Please join me now in welcoming Professor Lynn Worsham.
Thank you, Julie, for that wonderful and moving introduction. I want to thank you all for coming here tonight. I know you're very busy at the end of the semester. There's a lot going on for all of us. It's also a very chilly and wet evening, and who wants to come out on an evening like this? My presentation tonight contributes to the relatively new and interdisciplinary field of trauma studies. As you know, my title is The Humanities in the Age of Catastrophe. The catastrophe to which my title refers is not only the global economic crisis that has ended life as we know it and has sent, according to World Bank figures, at least 50 million people into poverty so far this year. The catastrophe that I'm principally concerned with here is the unprecedented violence of the 20th century and the violence that has consumed the first decade of the 21st century, threatening to make it even more deadly than the last. We may well have experienced unprecedented advances in the civilization in this same period. Still, I join with Walter Benjamin in saying that there is no document of civilization which is not at the same time a document of barbarism. Since the end of the Cold War and the advent of the so-called War on Terror, including the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, the world has seemed to spin dangerously out of control, with governmental and non-governmental entities alike turning almost without hesitation to violence as if it were the only idiom in which to advance their interests or settle their disputes. And they do so with little apparent regard for human life or human suffering. Let me pause for a moment to trouble you with a few sobering statistics. It is estimated that approximately 262 million people were killed in the 20th century by their own governments through famine, mass murder, and genocide. This figure includes 200,000 dead in the genocide in Bosnia-Herzegovina between 1992 and 1995. But it does not include the estimated 50,000 women and girls who were systematically raped during this war, many in so-called rape camps. This figure includes 800,000 dead as a result of the genocide in Rwanda and the nearly 3 million dead in the Congo, both of which occurred in 1994. It does not include the tens of thousands of women and girls raped and sometimes gang raped in those conflicts. It includes the 2 million dead in Cambodia between 1975 and 1979, the 7 million who died in the Ukrainian famine in 1932 and 33, including 3 million children, and the Armenian genocide, where 1.5 million people died between 1915 and 1918. This figure does not include those who died in wars, both soldiers and civilians, such as the 16 million dead in World War I, the 50 million dead in World War II, the 3 million dead in the Korean War, and the 3 million dead in the Vietnam conflict. And these are only some of the sobering realities that characterize the age of catastrophe. We have also become far too familiar with this in this catastrophic age with such predatory figures as the suicide bomber, increasingly the female suicide bomber, the terrorist executioner, the child soldier, the rampage murderer, the spree serial killer, and the family annihilator. We have witnessed the transformation of homes, schools, universities, workplaces, malls, churches, nursing homes, and community centers into scenes of mass injury and death. We have learned a new language for naming violence: ethnic cleansing, going postal, wilding, workplace mobbing, cyber stalking, and identity theft. And these are only a few of the terms in the new vocabulary of violence. Over the last century, the surfeit of slaughter has taken place at the same time that millions of lives have been wasted by poverty, unemployment, and underemployment, by chronic hunger and malnutrition, by preventable diseases and avoidable disabilities, by human trafficking, forced labor, and sexual exploitation, and by the displacement of forced migration made necessary by war and civil conflict. In far too many locations around the world, violence in some form has become the regulative principle of everyday life. We are living in what psychologist Robert J. Lifton calls a death-saturated age. Given this terrible and terrifying context of violence, and given the threat of nuclear catastrophe, Lifton argues that we are all survivors of catastrophe, our experience inescapably and profoundly marked by death and the violence of our time. For a quarter of a century, my own research has been motivated by my desire, my compulsion really, to grapple with what I believe is the most urgent social problem of our time, and a problem that provides the social and historical context in which the disciplines comprising the humanities continually to labor to question and to understand the meaning of being human. In this catastrophic age, where outrageous forms of violence become the violence of everyday life, the humanities survive to reconnect us to a common humanity. Ernst Bloch puts the challenge this way: the philosophy one has does not depend solely on the kind of person one is. It depends more essentially on the time in which one lives, and above all, on the way in which one belongs to that time. How will we belong to this time? My need to understand this catastrophic age surely has been shaped by my own coming of age in the 1960s, and in some sense witnessing the violence of that decade. The assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, and Martin Luther King Jr., the Vietnam War and its devastation of lives and land, the campus protests against the war that led to too many student deaths at the hands of our government, the violence, often televised and photographed, committed against African Americans, including African American children, as they sought, primarily through nonviolent resistance, to obtain the civil rights that had long been denied them, the riots in Harlem, Watts, Newark, Detroit, and D.C., the mass murders in Austin, Chicago, and L.A., to name only a few of the most publicized cases. For most of those years, I lived in the segregated South, where Jim Crow still prevailed, if not always in law, then in obligatory social conventions that policed the possibilities of human interaction. Images of violence and the sense of peril that were broadcast on the nightly news gave a shape to the inchoate tension and fear that percolated just below the surface of everyday life in those years in the South. Seeing the sign "Whites Only" over the water fountain at Leonard's department store instilled in me, long before I could fully articulate it, a sense that I was directly and personally implicated in a history of violent policies and practices and the suffering they produce. In retrospect, I see that the 1960s were especially formative of certain intellectual choices that I would make much later on. Those choices led me in a somewhat circuitous route through clinical psychology to the humanities, where I found my area of specialization in rhetorical theory. So in order to set the context even further, permit me to digress briefly into some disciplinary history. I promise to keep it short. Rhetoric as a theory of effective discourse in its practice originated in 5th century BCE Greece as an alternative to violence. In language, classical theorists found resources for framing and resolving disputes in courts of law and in the public arena, with the goal of substituting discursive contests in politics and law for the physical, psychological, and social agonies of war. Classical theorists began a tradition of thought that seeks the resolution of conflicts of belief in reasoned persuasion rather than through force, manipulation, and violence. From its inception, rhetorical theory has been concerned with what anchors belief in the body and the mind, with what moves an individual or a group to change beliefs. From its inception, then, rhetoric has been concerned with motive and motivation and with change and transformation. Modern rhetorical theorists have also pursued an understanding of rhetoric as an alternative to violence, but because they felt compelled to address an urgent social and historical milieu characterized by massive violence, our catastrophic age, they have also broadened the scope of investigation to include rhetoric as a crucial antecedent to an instrument of violence. Writing in the Cold War era, eminent philosopher and rhetorician Kenneth Burke, for example, was moved by our historically unique capacity to annihilate the human race through the development and proliferation of nuclear weapons. He developed a view of language as a form of symbolic action. He was interested in what we can do with language as instrument and agency. He shifted attention from persuasion to the ways in which we employ language and complex symbol systems to create identity and identification. He was especially concerned with the way we employ language to identify particular individuals or groups as scapegoats whose subordination, marginalization, or expulsion from society is accomplished first through a choice of words, through a developed way of conceiving. He called the symbolic practice of scapegoating the tragedy of victimage, which is essentially a rhetorical strategy for creating social solidarity, a sense of we-ness, through the creation of the other. While classical theorists viewed rhetoric as an alternative to violence, Burke reconceived rhetoric as both the disease and the cure, to use his terms, by which he meant that violence or victimage, the disease, arises from the same source as the cure, from the very terms in which we frame a given problem, terms that train us to look in one direction rather than another for possible solutions. An example that Burke would find tragically ironic is that we employ the metaphor of war as a way to achieve a solution to violence. The war on terror, the war on drugs, the war on poverty, and torture as an antidote to terrorism. In the philosophy and rhetoric of victimage, violence can only beget more violence. In my own effort to contribute to this ongoing conversation about rhetoric and violence, I have sought over the years to develop a rhetorical perspective on what I think has been inadequately understood for far too long, the relation between violence and emotion. As an indicator of this inattention, one example deserves special mention. The otherwise comprehensive multidisciplinary volume, Handbook of Emotions, which contains no fewer than 43 chapters, written by eminent scholars and researchers in the humanities, social sciences, and natural sciences, fails to include a chapter that focuses on the relation between emotion and violence, and only a handful of chapters make the most general and casual mention of aggression, which is not precisely synonymous with violence. Still, it has only been in the last 25 years or so that emotion has become a subject of substantive multidisciplinary inquiry. My own scholarly interest in emotion has also been shaped by rhetorical theory, for it is the first Western discipline to offer a systematic treatment of emotion, beginning with Aristotle's discussion of pathos in the Rhetoric. Pathos means, depending on context, emotion, emotional appeal, or suffering in the sense of undergoing an experience or an event. I have found all three senses of this term useful in investigating what I see as the reciprocal relation between emotion and violence, the role that emotion plays in creating the context for violence to occur, and the role that violence plays in shaping our affective lives. In the nexus of the relationship between emotion and violence, we find urgent questions about the politics of suffering. or the myriad ways in which human misery is manufactured and unevenly distributed. We also find indications of how our obligations to one another must change. A significant part of this project has been an effort to clarify the sense in which emotion is fundamentally social and political in nature, in contrast to the view that emotion always arises from within and expresses a purely internal state that is private and more or less idiosyncratic and unique to the individual. The view that emotion is social and expresses a social relation is part of a larger understanding of human identity as essentially social. In other words, that the self develops in ongoing social relations with others. In several publications, I have sought to demonstrate that emotion is an important social and political category, and I have pursued this idea through an examination of ideology. I argue that the primary work of ideology is more fundamental than simply the imposition of a dominant framework of ideas or beliefs or assumptions or even a set of enabling conditions, which is often the way that scholars in the humanities treat ideology. I argue that the strongest and subtlest appeal of any given ideology is through emotion, that ideology works most effectively through emotion to construct us as particular kinds of individuals. Ideology's primary work, then, is to organize an emotional world by inculcating historically specific patterns of feeling that support and perpetuate the legitimacy of dominant interests, patterns that are deemed especially appropriate to reigning gender, race, and class relations, as well as norms governing sexuality. Ideologies of gender, race, class, and sexuality are properly understood, at least in large part, as ideologies of emotion. They provide the conditions in which a primary affective mapping of the individual psyche occurs, one that sets the stage for all subsequent socialization. Ideology locates individuals objectively in a hierarchy of power relations, but also, and more importantly, it organizes their affective relations to those locations, to their own condition of subordination, and to others in that hierarchical structure. Ideology binds each individual to the social world through a complex and often contradictory affective life that too often remains, for the most part, privatized and invisible. And its success depends on the mystification or misrecognition of this primary work. The rhetoric of democracy and equality notwithstanding, the United States is a highly stratified society that is organized by the interacting structures of class privilege, white racism, patriarchy, and heterosexism, which are all terms for what sociologists and political theorists call forms of structural violence that create and maintain social hierarchies. Forms of structural violence turn difference into an occasion for systematic discrimination, domination, and exploitation, and the deprivation of needs that these structures rationalize. For too many people, forms of structural violence operate almost invisibly, doling out real and symbolic capital according to gender, for example, or skin color, and they make scapegoating a regulative principle of everyday life. What's more, forms of structural violence, such as patriarchy and class privilege, produce and reproduce in individuals an array of emotions that may be transient emotional responses to specific situations or pervasive affective states that regulate every aspect of a person's life. The misogyny, for example, that sexism produces is a learned but deeply held disposition of fear and hatred. It is a pervasive affective relation not only to women, but also to the world. It is not, first of all, an error in thought amenable to correction through cognitive retraining. Likewise, racism is first and foremost a learned disposition of fear and loathing of racialized individuals and groups. Such terms as sexism, racism, class privilege, and heterosexism are convenient shorthand terms for histories of emotion and for experiences of traumatic violence. While emotions and affective states may be socially produced, The smooth and efficient functioning of the social order is ensured only if our understanding of emotion is depoliticized, which means that we don't see or don't see very clearly how, for example, forms of structural violence work on us affectively. In the United States today, popular cultural forms and therapeutic culture have considerable power and influence. Together, they work to mystify emotions by making them purely a matter of personal psychology and private psychopathology. Popular culture and therapeutic culture seek to keep us focused entirely and narcissistically on ourselves, and perhaps a few close relatives and friends, not on distant lands and certainly not on distant others, whose religious and cultural traditions may be quite different from those most Americans recognize and respect. In keeping our attention focused on the self, popular culture and therapeutic culture keep us focused on satisfying our need for personal significance through the pleasures of consumerism, or what is referred to most recently as the ownership experience, and the so-called unique feelings of personal experience. The ideology of what probably should be called hyper-individualism, our deep attachment to the idea of the free and autonomous individual whose first, if not only, responsibility is to him or herself, exerts a powerful emotional appeal, for it constructs, at the same time, confers a sense of personal significance on the individual. This particular ideology actively conceals the fact that so-called personal life always takes shape in social and cultural terms. It also conceals the fact that the fate of each of us is deeply connected to the welfare of all, even those in distant, dark lands. In focusing on the social nature of emotion, I do not mean to discount or discredit what the sciences, evolutionary psychology, and neuroscience in particular, offer to an understanding of emotion. On the contrary, in my middle age, after years of being a strict social constructionist, I have been convinced by the compelling case that affective neuroscience makes for the existence in the brain of neural substrata that support and channel basic emotion systems such as fear and rage. Evolutionary psychology also makes a cogent case for the evolution of those basic emotional substrata as solutions to different adaptive problems that arose during our evolutionary history and that orchestrated every aspect of mind, brain, and behavior for survival. Research in neuroscience and evolutionary psychology indicates that neurological aspects of basic emotion systems have evolved from ancestral challenges of such importance that they have become genetically encoded in the subcortical circuits of the brains we inherit. In our distant history, perhaps the greatest challenge was to avoid, through skill or luck, becoming dinner for a larger, more skillful predator. This was a struggle for survival that, in Barbara Ehrenreich's view, is the trauma in our evolutionary history. In her view, the passions produced by this original trauma get restaged again and again in the collective trauma of war, and it is this trauma from which our penchant for violence has evolved. Today, the challenge is to avoid becoming the kill of any number of predatory figures and structures. Both affective neuroscience and evolutionary psychology acknowledge the dynamic interaction of the brain with the social and cultural milieu, past and present. Both disciplines propose that layers of learning, or what some might call the contents of ideological interpolation, may be mapped onto or activate ancient and enduring neurobiological structures in the brain that play a key role in organizing the neurophysiological aspects of affective experience. Thus, we might speculate that historically specific styles of mothering or ideologies of nurturance activate a genetic predisposition to social bonding, a predisposition that surely must have evolved precisely because the human infant is born entirely dependent on others for its survival. More generally, a range of emotions such as shame, pride, guilt, jealousy, hate, empathy, and loyalty, in other words, emotions that are properly termed feelings because they have a culturally defined cognitive content or core idea, may be grafted onto more primitive or basic neural substrata but may have no distinct neurological basis of their own. For example, it has long been thought that empathy is entirely learned and is therefore a matter of nurture, not nature. But in the early 1990s, neuroscientists discovered what has been called the mirror neuron, which some argue forms the biological basis for our capacity to feel what others feel. The view of emotion that I propose here recognizes that there are undoubtedly neurobiological structures in the brain that have evolved as substrata of emotion, and recognizes that there is a physiological component to many emotions, but maintains that emotion is primarily social in the sense that a given culture provides the parameters in which one may feel various emotions, such as shame, disgust, humiliation, love, pride, and joy. This view of emotion is especially productive, it seems to me, and for at least three reasons. First, it acknowledges that the whole story of human emotion cannot be told by any one discipline or field. That anything like a comprehensive understanding of emotion will only emerge from the combined efforts of the sciences, the social sciences, and the humanities, working with some knowledge of the limits of their own approaches and with some knowledge of the potential contribution from other disciplines. Second, it suggests a way to understand how layers of learning, that is, how ideologies, may be anchored in ancient and enduring neurological substrata of the brain, and as a consequence, exert an especially powerful and deep affective hold on our hearts and minds. Third, it allows us to move closer, as I will show, to a better understanding of the fateful relation between emotion and violence. I want to elaborate on these last two points, which requires that I outline in an all too general way my approach to an understanding of violence. Violence in the context of this research carries the intention or perceived intention of causing physical, psychological, or social injury, and sometimes all three simultaneously. Violence is never simply instrumental, a means to an end, nor is it senseless or meaningless or irrational, as many people routinely lament in the immediate aftermath of, say, one of the rampage killings that have been in the headlines recently. When we view the phenomenon of violence as senseless or meaningless or beyond comprehension, which we are invited and even exhorted to do almost daily by the media, we refuse our own implication in and our responsibility for the context of social relations in which violence might be said to constitute a mode of address that shapes us affectively in complex ways that we would prefer to disavow. We take refuge in that disavow, which holds us apart from violence as if innocent and uninvolved, and we embody the lie that we are neither perpetrators nor victims nor beneficiaries, that we are more nearly spectators than witnesses and survivors. What's more, we disregard not only what violence tells us about the quality and character of our social bonds, but also, and more importantly, how it functions rhetorically to solidify those bonds. Violence is itself rhetorical, and to understand the rhetoric of violence, I suggest we view violence both as a form of symbolic action and as symbolic language. It is meaningful, expressive, communicative, and purposive. As action and language, violence does something beyond the injury that it apparently intends. To clarify what I mean by the rhetoric of violence, the ways in which violence functions as symbolic action and as a mode of address, I think it is important to remember that all forms of violence, direct physical violence, structural violence, and symbolic violence must be understood in relation to each other and the injuries they produce. In the years I've spent investigating the problem of violence, I have been convinced that we really need a capacious notion of violence, one with the broadest possible scope, one that allows us to investigate a wide range of phenomena. From criminal acts perpetrated by individuals against individuals, to large-scale intergroup violence that may also produce crimes against humanity. From forms of so-called legitimate violence, such as war and capital punishment, to extreme forms of violence, such as terrorism and torture, that are deemed illegitimate. From instances of structural violence that create and maintain social hierarchies, such as poverty and white racism, to symbolic forms that may represent violence, enact violence, or solicit violent behavior, such as verbal abuse, hate speech, and, arguably, pornography. In calling for a broad and inclusive notion of violence, I do not mean to ally differences in degree or kind, either in forms of violent acts or in the kinds of injury and damage that result. Genocide and ethnic cleansing arguably occur on a scale that, say, domestic abuse does not, although some feminists, myself included, argue the contrary, saying that domestic violence is part of a pattern and practice of violence against women that is ancient and enduring and as systematic as any genocide. However important in clarifying such distinctions are, I am convinced that distinct forms of violence are linked, that they may be linked in complex, multiple, and oblique ways that must be investigated, and that forms and instances of violence interact, mutually reinforce one another, and provide the conditions of possibility for other forms of violence to occur. Likewise, it is imperative that we examine different forms and experiences of injury and the ways that they may interact to produce violent acts. For it is in the experience of traumatic injury and the emotions such injury produces that we find the roots of much of the violence that characterizes this catastrophic age. So let me say something about the nature of the injury that violence intends, the nature of the injury that produces violent action. Physical violence injures in a direct and visible way. The wound that it inflicts lays open the body and thereby opens the body to the immediate experience of crushing pain, to the potential for lasting harm in the form of chronic pain or disability or disfigurement, and ultimately and most importantly to the overwhelming experience of the threat or reality of physical death. Physical pain always mimes death, as Elaine Scarry argues in The Body in Pain. And the infliction of physical pain is always a mock execution. In opening the body to these extreme experiences, all physical violence enacts an essential element of torture, which stages the conversion of overwhelming pain into the fiction of absolute power, the absolute right to destroy self, language, and world. Forensic psychiatrist James Gilligan explains, "Violence to the body causes the death of the self because it is so inescapably humiliating. When we cannot fend off, undo, or escape from such overwhelmingly unloving acts, when we cannot protect ourselves from them, whether by violent or nonviolent means, something gets killed within us. Our souls are murdered." All this is implicit in the double meaning of the word that most directly and literally refers both to the death of the self and to what causes the death of the self, namely mortification, which means both humiliation and causing death. The violation that is the central act of violence must be understood in its double sense, as the violation that humiliates and mortifies the body, the self, and the world of meaning. Violation is the core experience, then, not only of physical violence, but of all forms of violence, including structural violence. And what makes violation possible is the ontological status of human beings as constitutively vulnerable. At birth and for some time thereafter, we are utterly powerless, helpless, defenseless, and dependent creatures. And thus our physical survival is linked to the quality of our social bonds, to the relative vigilance of our caregivers, on whom we depend entirely for nourishment, protection, and comfort. There is nothing reciprocal about this first social relation for the helpless and dependent infant. Survival depends on the satisfaction of basic needs, and satisfaction feeds the infant's narcissistic fantasy of magical omnipotence. Yet satisfaction and the fantasy of omnipotence alternate with experiences of frustration, deprivation, separation, and a fear of abandonment. This original condition of physical vulnerability and powerlessness is psychically overwhelming and unbearable for the danger it poses. And therefore, it is affectively colored first with a fear of separation and later with the terror of death. This original condition of vulnerability to others marks each of us deeply and for the rest of our lives. We carry it with us as the memory of an original trauma that makes us profoundly vulnerable to others. And according to many trauma theorists, this original trauma is recalled and restaged in our experience of events, in our response to events occurring throughout our lives that we perceive to be threatening. In an essay published posthumously in Harper's Magazine, Benjamin DeMott speculates on what he sees as a very real threat, the American addiction to what he calls the pornography of violence, or bioporn, as he abbreviates it. Bioporn is made possible by media and computer technology, which together produce, in his words, the pathological culture of replay and its make-it-happen-again rights, the right to rewind and replay and repeat, and its demand to see it again and again and again on the big screen in your home theater and on the small screen of your handheld device. Bioporn creates what DeMott identifies as impact hunger, or the desire to see another crushing, full-throttle collision, another body blown to bits, more flaming, flying bodies falling from the towers, more scenes of soul-crushing, flesh-rending, savored human destruction. Images of destruction are offered up by media culture, by film, television, the internet, video games, which, as the millennium approached, became especially fascinated with violence and disaster scenarios of all kinds. Impact hunger is also stoked and fed each day by news of the immeasurable brutalities of war, genocide, terrorist attacks, mass rape, and rampage killings. Yet today's impact hunger also owes something to an earlier time, as DeMott notes. Writing half a century ago, Adorno observed about the automobile, "What driver is not tempted merely by the power of his engine to wipe out the vermin of the street, pedestrians, children, cyclists? The movement that machines demand of their users have the violent, hard-hitting, unresting jerkiness of fascist maltreatment." Impact hunger can be traced back further still to the practices of scapegoating and sacrifice that stand at the foundation of nationalistic fervor and at the birth of religious faith. It is a mistake, DeMott warns, to fail to reckon the ecstasy of impact, the joy of slaughter. The sacrificial logic of the techna of replay produces, in the words of DeMott, the violence-addicted hard man self. Male or female, the hard man self feeds on fantasies of obliteration, or at minimum, fantasies of inflicting pain that shocks and awes. These fantasies, DeMott argues, generate a direct or near direct experience of explosive strength. In the global present of the fast and crash of impact, video games, for example, constitute kindergarten prep for the crash-empowered kid who grows up to become a crash-empowered, bio-pornified adult who wants terrible news to be worse and relishes catastrophe whose bottom can't be sounded. For the hard man, male or female, the day-to-day content of mind and heart is shaped by the nightly casualty report. Day-to-day declines in the number of casualties cause serious disappointment within the hard man, a discernible letdown. "Explode us another Humvee," the hard man says. "Break, blast, and burn our helpless countrymen. Mock and humiliate the mad authorities once more. Lengthen the list of the dead." In DeMott's searing and self-critical view, he confesses to finding the hard man within himself, the simplifying cruelty of replay claims the right to erase nuance and context, the right to disconnect impact from actual or imagined injury, pain, death, the right to murder sympathy, the right to erase love and human decency. The 21st century is already an impact-saturated age. Vile porn is clearly a mode of rhetorical address that creates the hard man self and his or her pervasive affective disposition to the world and to others. This disposition is characterized by feelings of distance, detachment, and cruelty. Dehumanization and desensitization are terms that we might be tempted to use to describe the existential condition of the hard man self. But DeMott says that these words explain nothing. I have to agree. They are pale, anemic terms for a reality that language cannot grasp because impact, vile porn, ultimately destroys meaning. What these words leave unexplained, and what DeMott only vaguely alludes to, is the fact that the trauma of mass-mediated violence produces the hard man self who is addicted to impact and the ecstasy of impact. The hard man self belongs to this time, the age of catastrophe. As the survivor of all the Holocausts of the 20th and 21st centuries, the survivor of the impact of each one of these terrible humiliations of our common humanity, the hard man self compulsively, self-destructively, and unknowingly restages the trauma of human vulnerability, thinking he can master vulnerability by murdering it with the techna of replay. The hard man self is the post-traumatic self. He or she only appears not to feel. On the contrary, feelings are split off, dissociated, unavailable to consciousness, much less to conscious reflection. Nothing appalls the hard man self because he is numbed to the point of boredom with anything but impact and the fantasies of explosive strength that impact installs. Impact alone makes him feel alive. He takes joy in slaughter rather than admit to himself that he is the slaughtered self of impact. He is a survivor in a world violently deprived of safety, where risk has become routine and the regulative principle of everyday life. The hard man self, like his ancestors, is a narcissistic personality who seeks a sense of his own significance and a sense of omnipotence or explosive strength in the latest commodity, that is, in impact. As DeMott himself acknowledges, the hard man self is the most recent replay of what D.H. Lawrence once described as the essential American soul, hard, isolate, stoic, and a killer, who seeks, in Richard Slotkin's memorable phrase, regeneration through violence. The hard man is not harmless. He or she is potentially very dangerous. The pathological culture of replay that produces the hard man self is a culture that produces killers. Serial killers, mass murderers, rampage killers, family annihilators, and that is the point. For existing in the midst of these predatory figures, we will also find men and women eager to kill and die for their cause, their religion, or their country. Violence begets violence in a culture in which significance, personal or social significance, is to be found in the heroics of having an impact. The hard man self, addicted to vile porn, is one vision of the future, a vision in which the future compulsively repeats the traumatic past. I would like to join with feminist philosopher and legal theorist Martha Nussbaum and propose an alternative. In Hiding from Humanity, Nussbaum writes, "What I am calling for, in effect, is something I do not expect we shall ever fully achieve, a society that acknowledges its own humanity, and neither hides us from it, nor it from us. A society of citizens who admit that they are needy and vulnerable, and who discard the grandiose demands for omnipotence and completeness that have been at the heart of so much human misery, both public and private. What I am calling for," Nussbaum continues, "is a society in which, at least in crafting the institutions that shape our common life together, we admit we are all children, and that in many ways we don't control the world. This, it seems to me, is a good way to proceed in a liberal society, by which I mean one based on a recognition of the equal dignity of each individual and the vulnerabilities inherent in a common humanity." To bring these remarks to an end, with time, I hope, for questions and comments, I want to move to the broadest level at which I conceptualize my work on violence and emotion. I see this work as a contribution to what I call cultural epidemiology. In medical science, epidemiology examines the incidence, distribution, and control of disease in a population. By analogy, cultural epidemiology examines the ways that social pathologies arise in, circulate through, and gain influence in, and dominate a given social milieu. There are several motives for my choice of terms for framing this project as a contribution to cultural epidemiology. One motive, but certainly not the most important one, is that I seek to reverse Plato's historic condemnation of rhetoric, a condemnation that was intended to be a thoroughgoing humiliation that rhetoric would never recover from. Plato had some success. Rhetoric has always labored under the burden of his condemnation. Plato famously declared that rhetoric was a sham art, inadequate in the pursuit of valid truth, and more akin to flattery and cookery than to any genuine pursuit of truth and justice, which he claimed as the exclusive province of philosophy. In framing my project as a contribution to cultural epidemiology, I am explicitly moving against Plato to align rhetoric with philosophy and justice, and especially with medicine, in an effort to make good on Kenneth Burke's historic claim that rhetoric has the power to diagnose and heal. More important, framing this project as a contribution to cultural epidemiology allows me to join with, for example, James Gilligan and historian Lloyd DeMose, who seek to make violence a public health issue, indeed the public health issue of our time. The intention here is to change the terms of discussion and move away from our habitual recourse to the language of crime and punishment, the language of retribution and revenge, and our investment, our deep investment, in the rhetoric of humiliation. Finally, the concept of cultural epidemiology suggests a vision of a shared purpose for the humanities, social sciences, and natural sciences, who might all work together to build a comprehensive understanding of forms of social suffering, including the various forms of violence that arise from and produce so much suffering for the vast majority of the world's population in our catastrophic age. Thank you for your presence here tonight. I am honored by your attention to this most unhappy topic.